We would like to take a moment to thank our sponsor, Preborn. When a mother meets her baby on an ultrasound and hears their heartbeat, it's a divine connection, and the majority of the time, she will choose life. But she can't do it without our help. Preborn needs us, the pro-life community, to come alongside her. One ultrasound is just $28. To donate, dial #250 and say the keyword baby, or visit preborn.com.
Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
I love talking about the things of God because of truth and the biblical worldview.
The U.S. Constitution obligates our government to preserve and protect the rights that our founders recognize come from God, our Creator, not our government. I believe that Scripture in the Bible is very clear that God is the one that raised up each of you, and God has allowed us to be brought here to this specific moment in time.
This is Jenna Ellis in the Morning.
Good morning. Well, Hunter Biden was found guilty of falsely claiming to be drug-free when applying to buy a handgun 6 years ago, adding to his family's personal turmoil as his father, President Biden, campaigns for re-election. This coming from the Wall Street Journal this morning. Biden, 54 years old, was convicted by a federal jury in a case that exposed a dark period of betrayal and substance abuse in the Biden family. The jury found that when Hunter bought this gun, this revolver, in October of 2018, he lied on a federal form by checking a box saying he wasn't addicted to or using drugs at the time. And so Mia Cathell, who is a reporter, actually posted a really extensive mega thread of all of the evidence admitted thus far in the Hunter Biden gun trial, or everything that ultimately was admitted. And if you are interested in going into the details, then I would refer you to that thread on X from Mia Cathell. And Speaker Mike Johnson had actually a really, I think, the best take on this. And of course, the talking points have been issued now. Are you voting for a convicted felon or the father of a convicted felon? And we know the way that all of the politicos are going to go. But Speaker Johnson posted this on his account at Speaker Johnson yesterday. He said, a year ago, Hunter Biden was offered a sweetheart deal that would have allowed him to bypass the justice system on these charges. Because whistleblowers spoke out and House Republicans sounded the alarm, Hunter was brought to court. Today, he was found guilty of all charges. Now it's time for the DOJ to investigate the millions of dollars in payouts from foreign countries looking to curry favor with his father. We will continue to demand accountability for the corrupt business dealings of the Biden family. So, yeah, we can't forget that in the midst of, Democrats saying, look at now the justice system isn't weaponized, and all of you who are crying foul for the Trump verdict in Manhattan and the alleged weaponizing of government over there. I mean, look, nobody is above the law. That even includes the president's son. And Biden has said that he's not going to pardon Hunter, which I think is completely ridiculous, because no matter what happens on November 5th, Joe Biden has the ability under the Constitution to pardon Hunter and not just commute whatever his sentence is, but have him escape the ramifications of having three felony convictions on November 6th. Even if Donald Trump is elected, Biden still has pardon power up and through noon on January 20th of next year. So that is likely coming. But we can't forget, in the midst of all of these other talking points, that Hunter Biden was offered that sweetheart deal, and David Weiss, who is the prosecutor, was fully intending to have that deal go through, and Hunter would have completely escaped all responsibility for this. We wouldn't have had this trial but for House Republicans and whistleblowers actually doing their job, and then ultimately the judge in that case reviewing the plea agreement and remarkably declining that. Typically, judges will, if the parties reach an agreement, as long as the agreement is legal, it's permitted under under criminal law and the statutory restrictions surrounding plea agreements, which are just basically a contract entered into with the prosecuting attorney's office and the defendant, then most judges are inclined to accept them, much like they would a contract or a stipulation in a civil instance. So this really wasn't about they're not being too tiered justice or somehow, you know, nobody is above the law or any of that nonsense. The Democrats are, of course, spinning it to their favor. And I thought Speaker Johnson was very wise to point that out. But let's welcome in our first guest this morning, Jim Nels, who is a businessman and also a political commentator and has writes for a wide variety of publications and has been following the Hunter Biden trial. So, Jim, I thought that, you know, you had some really good insights into this because, you know, a lot of people are rushing to these very siloed partisan talking points and saying, you know, just because Hunter Biden is the son of Joe Biden and therefore a political opponent, and because of all of the stuff in Burisma, which had nothing to do with this particular trial, then, you know, he should be locked away for the 25 years that is a potential sentence in this instance. But I think, you know, rational people kind of are taking a step back and not going to extremes on either side. So what say you?
So we as conservatives have to believe in the rule of law, right? And if you look at people who have committed the same crime as Hunter Biden and been convicted of those three felonies, they typically get probation unless, of course, that the gun that they purchased illegally was used in another crime or they have a history of violent crime. And I think that's what we should be looking for here. We don't want to be vindictive. We don't want to go forth and just try to punish Hunter Biden because he's the son of Joe Biden. The other thing that I think is very interesting with Joe Biden saying that he won't pardon his son, I actually think President Trump should come out and say that if elected, he will pardon Hunter. And I think Trump should come out and say, I'm glad that Hunter has got his life back together. I'm glad that he's become, you know, allegedly clean and sober. And I think Trump should take the high road here because I think it puts him in a wonderful position and will show that we conservatives believe in the rule of law, but we also believe in forgiveness and we believe in second chances. And if he can do what Hunter Biden's father won't do, I think that would put him in a wonderful position right now.
That's actually really great advice to take the vitriol from both sides and to severely undermine that and actually mitigate it by coming out and saying, you know, listen, we can't have any of this weaponized either way and pledge to that, because then that would put an onus on the Democrats to maybe do that in his own cases as well, and for both sides to perhaps come to some sort of agreement to not weaponize any you know, state or federal offices against political opponents. And what's interesting here as well, from a conservative perspective, you know, we can't forget that while obviously lying on forms like what Hunter was convicted of in two of the charges, he lied on a federal form, checking a box saying he wasn't addicted or using drugs at the time, which the jury found was false. And you can't do that, and nobody is saying that that's okay. But we can look at the overall restrictions for the Second Amendment and say, you know, is this something that the federal government should be regulating anyway? And maybe use this instance to undermine the Democrats and their attempts to severely restrict Second Amendment protections and say, hey, you know, we need to recontemplate, you know, all of these things in light of the national attention on this case.
No, I agree with you 100%. I do not like any restriction on the Second Amendment. I am pro-Second Amendment. You know, the first federal laws governing the Second Amendment went into place in the mid-30s during the height of the Chicago gangland wars, and they basically outlawed machine guns. But I don't think that you want to have any restrictions on something that's guaranteed to us in the Constitution. You don't want to hear restrictions on, Jenna, your right to vote as a woman, do you? That you can only vote the way a man tells you to vote, or maybe you can only vote in local elections and not federal elections because, you know, you women just can't understand the things that we men can understand at the federal level. Why would you take that sort of logic and apply it to the Second Amendment if you would be laughed out of a room if you try to apply it to the right of women to vote, the right of minorities to vote, the right of blacks to be citizens of the United States? It's a ridiculous argument. I don't want drug addicts and alcoholics running around with guns, but I would take one of them getting a gun in order to allow the rest of us to have the total freedom that the Second Amendment is supposed to guarantee us under the Constitution.
Yeah, and I love that you are comparing women to crackheads on this program. I mean, so, you know, there's that. So bravo, Jim Nels. But no, but your point is very well taken that the entire point of our U.S. Constitution is to guarantee liberty to our citizens and protections from our government on both the state and federal level, and to not arbitrarily and pre-enforce restrictions before choices are made to violate laws. So for example, I mean, I'm all for gun rights to be restricted when someone has gone out and used one unlawfully. Then, okay, we can talk about that. Just like liberty can be foreclosed when due process has been ultimately fulfilled and someone is found guilty of an offense and they deserve jail time, for example. And so rights can be foreclosed in various instances, but it has to be after due process. And so to require these kind of just all of these different parameters and restrictions around possessing a firearm. I mean, and there's an obvious difference between owning a gun versus, for example, exercising free speech, but it would be like saying, okay, you can't get a social media platform account unless you fill out a federal form that checks the box that says that you're not addicted to drugs or you're not an alcoholic. I mean, and you are presumed to be unfit by the government in exercising a right unless and until you prove otherwise. And our system doesn't work that way. And so when it comes to particularly the Second Amendment, we need to, as conservatives, like you said, make sure legislatively and with our vote and with all of our policy advocacy that we protect that basic right of self-defense. Regardless of, you know, some of these people that would go out and use guns in terrible ways. I mean, they can use all kinds of other artifices to commit crimes as well. And so it's not about, as we always say, it's not about the gun, it's about the person. So I think exactly. That's really, yeah, go ahead.
No, I was going to say, and you know me, Jenna, I would never compare a woman to a crackhead because I love women. I hate crackheads.
I'm just giving you a hard time because it's weird. That was just so funny.
I know. But maybe a better analogy is, you know, as a parent, on Friday night, I don't punish my children before they go to the party. I give them the opportunity to go to the party and make good decisions. And then if they do something stupid, I punish them after they do something stupid. What people who are anti-Second Amendment want to do is punish the people before they go out on Friday night because they might do something wrong. And that's not the way that we're supposed to act as human beings, and that's not how we're supposed to act as citizens. Now, getting back to the Second Amendment, again, we all have the right to keep and bear arms. That is written to us in the Constitution. It was the number two thing that they said the government could not infringe upon. And we have to continue to understand that. And as conservatives, we should say you have to give a person the chance to do the right thing or punish them for doing the wrong thing before you take something away from him or her.
Yes. We are not about pre-enforcement of crime. That is something that our founders specifically contemplated. I mean, this is discussed in the Federalist Papers and the entire idea of a constitutional republic and rights that are pre-political, that come from God, our creator, not our government, and the purpose of government being to protect and preserve those rights. This all goes to that central proposition that an individual has to first decide to do something that violates a legitimate prohibition in society, and then their rights or liberties can be foreclosed. But should they be foreclosed into perpetuity? I mean, this is something that then you contemplate sentencing. So just in the last minute I have with you, Jim Nels, should Hunter Biden get jail time?
No, he should not. He's not a violent criminal. The weapon, the firearm that he purchased was not used in a subsequent crime. He should get probation. And again, I think that either his father or Donald Trump should go ahead and pardon him after this is over. Let's put this behind us. Let's take the high road for the country. But I also think that Joe Biden should pardon Donald Trump for everything that's going on here. And let's just run this race based on the merits of the two politicians, not on persecution via prosecution.
Yeah. I mean, and this, the election should really be about policy and what's good for American citizens, not just tuning into court TV every day. I mean, this is the crazy reality TV situation that we're living in right now in America. But Jim Nelz, really appreciate it. And you can follow Jim at Real Jim Nelz on X and look at all of his great writings and op-eds there. But we'll be right back with more here on Jenna Ellis in the Morning.
Hi, I'm Jan Harper.
And I'm Bert.
If you're a pastor's wife, you know both the blessings and the unique challenges that come with the life you and your husband live daily. We call it living in the fishbowl.
The 2024 Pastors and Wives Fishbowl Retreat is coming October 22nd through 24th. This year's retreat will be at Pickwick Landing State Park in Counts, Tennessee. As always, the Fishbowl Retreat is hosted by Pastor Bert Harper of American Family Radio and his wife Jan. Our special speaker will be Dr. Ray Pritchard, co-host of Today's Issues on AFR, and his wife, Marlene. Registration is open now and space is limited. Your registration fee of $400 per couple covers lodging, meals, and materials. Come get some much-needed encouragement at the Fishbowl Retreat. Learn more and register at repairingthefoundations.net. That's repairingthefoundations.net.
The AFA Pastors and Wives Fishbowl Retreat. We'd love to see you there.
Welcome back to Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
Well, the left is waging war against our institutions and the justice system in multiple ways, and this includes gunning very hard for Justice Samuel Alito, and they have been openly attacking him for just ridiculous nonsense and kind of this, you know, these made-up sort of controversies to, I think, put pressure on Alito to not only recuse himself in several cases without any sort of actual legal justification or merit, and even further than that, potentially force him into retirement so that, of course, the Democrats would have the option currently of replacing him. And this is just not at all the way that our system should function at all. And so in the midst of the flag controversy where Justice Alito's wife apparently flew a United States flag upside down, which is well known as a symbol of distress, and then this appeal to heaven flag, which is not really a political statement, but even if it were, the spouses of judicial officers are not restricted in any way from political activity, and it's just really not a controversy. I mean, if a justice flew a Christian flag outside of their vacation home because their spouse put it up, it's just really not a big deal. I mean, I think it would be a totally different thing if they were flying a Trump 2024 flag. That would be political activity that, even if it was his wife, would maybe not reflect so well on the justice. And then, you know, we could have that conversation. But even then, his spouse has the right to engage in political activity, which is exactly what Jenny Thomas, the wife of Justice Clarence Thomas, is routinely engaged in, because she's basically a almost a full-time, if not at least part-time, political operative, and she engages in politics, and that's completely fine. That is completely legal, and yet the left is trying to manufacture controversy. So the latest thing after the flag nonsense failed to get Justice Alito to recuse himself or to nonsensically hail Chief Justice Roberts in to meet with a couple of the Senate Democrats, which Justice Roberts very wisely wrote a letter to Senator Schumer and a couple of the Democrats and said, you know, basically, no thanks, but no thanks. That would not be wise or look in any way impartial for him to meet behind closed doors with only one party and to discuss all of this. So now the left is going after Justice Alito in a different way. This piece came exclusively because, you know, big bombshell from Rolling Stone yesterday. And the headline is Justice Alito caught on tape. And get this, this is just such a bombshell. He was caught on tape discussing how the battle for America can't be compromised. In a new secret recording, the Supreme Court justice says he agrees that the United States should return to a place of godliness. Like, oh no, this is just the worst thing ever, and this is such a bombshell. And the Wall Street Journal had a great opinion piece yesterday evening that, and I love this headline, Justice Alito stands falsely accused of candor. Rolling Stone tries to make a scandal out of a surreptitiously taped remark and goes on to say Justice Samuel Alito began the week facing an accusation of excessive candor. Although the charge was leveled by Rolling Stone magazine, it seemed plausible because he is unusually outspoken for a sitting jurist. But it's a bum rap. In this instance, what Justice Alito had to say was about as interesting as a seminar on real estate law. And I will just, as an aside, as a lawyer, we are required to do continuing learning education credits every 3 years. I have sat through real estate law seminars. They are indeed very boring. That was a wonderful analogy, and I laughed out loud reading that. It goes on to say, the magazine, Rolling Stone, claims that Justice Alito, quote, spoke candidly about the ideological battle between the left and the right, discussing the difficulty of living peacefully with ideological opponents in the face of fundamental differences that can't be compromised. So this is just so ridiculous, but I want you to listen to the actual comments from Justice Alito. And it was to this reporter who did surreptitiously record this. It was at an event that was actually closed to the press. So this person, Lauren Windsor, is her name. She's very open on X and posted this exclusive undercover audio on her account just to advance this ridiculous narrative. So she's very open about being the one that surreptitiously recorded this. And she posed as someone who was just asking very innocuous questions and really sincerely wanting to side with some of what she presumed, and I think rightly presumed, to be Justice Alito's ideological persuasions. And yet there's just nothing here. So listen to this clip, and the voice you'll hear that's a woman is the undercover, and I don't even want to call her a journalist. I think she's an activist, clearly, the undercover activist, and then having this conversation with Justice Alito. And remember, you know, he's thinking he's just engaging with someone in the crowd who is asking a sincere question. So this is cut five.
Hi, I wanted to say hello to you again. My name's Lauren. I met you last year. I think you already met so anyway, I wanted to tell you, my husband wanted to be here, but in Austin, as he's saying, and just like make sure that you tell Justice Alito that like he is a fighter and we appreciate him and he has all the grit. And I know it's got to be terrible what your family, what you and your family are going through right now. So I'm just so sorry.
Oh, thank you. Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
But, and I'm sure you don't remember this at all, but what I had asked you about was about the polarization in this country, about like how do we repair that rift. And considering everything that's been going on in the past year, you know, as a Catholic and as someone who like really cherishes my faith, I don't know that we can negotiate with the left in the way that like needs to happen for the polarization to end. I think that it's a matter of like winning.
I think you're probably right. I mean, one side or the other is going to win. I don't know. I mean, there can be a way of living together peacefully, but it's difficult, you know, because there are differences on fundamental things that really can't be compromised. So it's not like we're going to split the difference.
And that's what I'm saying. I think that the solution really is like winning the moral argument. Like, people in this country who believe in God have got to keep fighting for that to return our country to a place of godliness.
Oh, I agree with you.
Because we look at, like, the decline of our society, the decline of a nuclear family, and liberals, I just feel like, want to see that happen and proliferate. And I think we've been too permissive to say, oh, you know, okay, I understand the Constitution.
All right, so that it was literally nothing. I mean, Justice Alito is very clearly being polite and kind, and he's being asked about a series of, you know, more philosophical and ideological questions. And I mean, one side or the other is going to win. That's just true. I mean, and that's not something that is recusal worthy or bombshell exclusive. You know, an 1800 word or so article from the Rolling Stone yesterday, and of course headlines, and the Democrats immediately latching on and saying, look at how you know, terribly politically active Justice Alito is, and it's so remarkably stupid. And so this activist, as the Wall Street Journal's opinion piece goes on to say, they say, you know, Lauren Windsor turned out to be lying to Justice Alito, and Rolling Stone describes her as a, quote, liberal documentary filmmaker who asked questions of the justice as though she were a religious conservative. So she met him by joining the Supreme Court Historical Society, bought a ticket to the annual dinner last week, also in 2023. So she posted some of the audio from back in 2023 as well, and going, you know, look, I had this this recording, you know, this exclusive recording of Alito where she surreptitiously recorded the conversations. And it's really remarkably unfair to this justice who, and Wall Street Journal also goes on to say she asked Justice Alito a series of leading questions to which he responds politely, just expressing opinions that aren't really offensive. He wasn't argumentative, and he's responding to questions. And I remember when I was in law school at University of Richmond School of Law, the Federalist Society and, you know, other different organizations that are on campus often bring in various speakers. And we actually had the opportunity to hear from then Justice Scalia. And it was amazing to you know, to get to meet him. And I remember a lot of my fellow students and the faculty there asking questions of the justice, and some of them were ideologically based, like, you know, how do you set aside your politics? And in that type of forum, especially for students, and in this instance, you know, the Supreme Court Historical Society, it's perfectly appropriate for a justice to explain their worldview and their how they do their job. And it's not meant to be in any way a commentary on pending cases. I mean, just like when potential federal judges and justices go in front of the judiciary, the Senate Judiciary Committee, for potential confirmation of their nomination, they're asked a lot of ideological questions, and very publicly. I mean, that is on the record. And the only thing that they don't do is comment on pending cases or cases that specific cases that may arise in front of them. So we all very famously remember Justice Barrett's confirmation hearing, and of course Kavanaugh's, and the, you know, the recent, the two most recent that we've had, being asked about their opinion on Roe versus Wade. And both of them said, you know, I'm not going to comment on how I would specifically rule. That's not in front of me. But, you know, in terms of the way that they operate in their judicial philosophy, that's perfectly acceptable to opine on. And I mean, I asked Justice Scalia, as a student, I asked if oral argument in front of the Supreme Court actually made any difference in the way that the justices ultimately rule on cases. And that's not asking a question on a specific case, like in this case that's pending before you, and this oral argument that you just heard yesterday, and you haven't released the opinion yet, did that persuade you? I mean, that would be, he would probably have declined to answer that specific of a question. But something more broadly that is commenting on the way that the Supreme Court functions, judicial philosophy overall, originalism, I mean, all of these more broader philosophical context, that's perfectly fine for justices to engage in that, and especially in a situation where, you know, they're at an event that is supposed to be off the record and engaging well-meaning people. I mean, even people who, you know, may have gone to the Supreme Court Historical Society that disagree with an opinion or a judicial philosophy. I mean, if a conservative met, for example, Justice Sotomayor and didn't agree with everything that she says from the bench, that's fine, right? And so to just put this in context, it's so beyond vile that Justice Alito is being attacked by the left for being polite. that's literally it. And for his wife, you know, flying a flag that harkens back to the revolution era. I mean, it's so beyond ridiculous. But then Carrie Severino, who is the president of the Judicial Network, she posted this on X yesterday with a link to a piece in The Hill that is really important in this conversation. And she said, Democrats are threatening to defund the Supreme Court as a way to force Chief Justice Roberts to adopt ethics reforms, or quote-unquote ethics reforms, in the wake of more manufactured controversies ginned up by the left. And this is exactly where they're going. And so this piece from The Hill, the title is Democrats See Supreme Court Leverage in Spending Bills. So with all of this other ridiculous stuff that's going on with, you know, the economy, the invasion at the border, you know, families being concerned about putting food on their table. I mean, all of these really important issues. The Democrats are focused on defunding the U.S. Supreme Court just because they want leverage over Chief Justice Roberts and forcing the Supreme Court to adopt quote unquote ethics reforms, which I'm very opposed to that, because even though obviously justices should stay within the bounds of ethics and they recuse themselves in cases where they know the parties, have personal interest, you know, have all of these different parameters that are very well known that guide their recusal. And Chief Justice Roberts wisely said in his response to the Democrats who asked him for a meeting that the decision to recuse is Alito's. It's his, and you know, he's not basically the playground monitor. And yet, if the left is successful in adopting these so-called ethics reforms in this code of judicial ethics that attaches to the Supreme Court, you can be absolutely guaranteed that they will simply weaponize it, and they will use it as a way purposefully to wield the power of impeachment that the House does have under the Constitution to impeach sitting U.S. Supreme Court justices. And so this is the Democrats trying to find every single loophole and maneuver possible within their power to force an outcome that they prefer. That is dirty politicking. That is not the way that they are supposed to exercise power. It's potentially smart. I mean, I wish Republicans would use their power to good ends and to protections in smart ways like the Democrats seem to. But this is very scary for the institution of justice and for our Supreme Court to see that the Democrats are actually looking at potentially defunding the Supreme Court. Can you imagine if that happened and we didn't have our Supreme Court? I mean, you know, Biden would be allowed to just go do whatever just to force Chief Justice Roberts to adopt ethics reform. I hope he doesn't cave. But, you know, all of this is just the Democrats' ridiculous agenda to force their own way. We'll be right back with more. You've heard a lot about saving babies on this show, and that's because it's important to me personally. And let me just be frank with you, we need to save them. That's why we've partnered with Preborn, the nation's leader in introducing mothers with unplanned pregnancies to their babies. And once she hears that heartbeat and sees that precious life growing inside of her, she is twice as likely to choose life. Now that's a miracle. But quite honestly, if we don't save them, who will? Preborn receives no government funding, so their work is completely dependent on us. Preborn has rescued over 280,000 babies. And that's not all. They provide love, support, and counseling for up to 2 years for free, saving lives and souls. One ultrasound is just $28, or $140, helps to rescue 5 babies' lives. Abortion doesn't stop, so we can't. Together, you and I can save lives. Just dial #250 on your cell and say the keyword baby. That's #250 baby. Or go to preborn.com. That's preborn.com.
Welcome back to Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
Welcome back. Well, speaking of weaponizing institutions in America and the left trying to weaponize everything, the whole entire COVID nonsense and the everything that surrounded 2020, what we heard from Dr. Fauci a couple of weeks ago in his testimony in front of Congress, and what we have continued to learn about how the leftists and the progressives have tried to weaponize that entire time period in the United States, and particularly tell specific doctors how to conduct their medical practice. And if you were a doctor that just gave your opinion that went against the government's preferred opinion, then there have been doctors that have been suspended, their medical licenses taken away. And this was a headline from the Houston Chronicle back in November of 2021. Houston Methodist suspends a River Oaks doctor for spreading COVID misinformation. The caption on X said the doctor sent her patients two emails last week in which she falsely claimed the vaccine wasn't working. Well, this doctor, Mary Tally Bowden, posted on social media this week, "I think the Houston Chronicle owes me an apology." And she joins us now. So, Dr. Tally Bowden, thank you so much for joining us. So let's go to your full story, because clearly you've been proven correct. And now all of these ridiculous government leftists and Dr. Fauci and everyone else have admitted that the vaccine wasn't effective in preventing the COVID-19 virus. And yet it seems that you were the recipient of being censored, defamed, retaliated against just because you had the wherewithal to actually practice medicine.
Yes. So I live in Houston, and the mandates started in Houston at Methodist Hospital. And Houston's home to the largest medical center in the world. We have this huge complex. I'm this solo physician. I'm in a small practice. My practice had only been open for 6 months, and I had privileges at Methodist, but I was not an integral part of their system. I'd never actually stepped foot in the hospital, and I just started, telling my patients what I was seeing and speaking out on social media, but I didn't really have much of a following at that time. I would tweet something, and I'd get like a one like. But they picked up on it, and they tried to destroy me. And like the tweet said, I just sent emails to my patients saying the vaccine wasn't working. And it was pretty innocuous. But they went to the Houston Chronicle and told the Chronicle they were suspending my privileges. And that's actually how I found out. So they didn't call me or have any kind of private discussion. They went straight to the media. And my life changed. I was swarmed with media requests. Not anything I was prepared for. I was completely blindsided. I just decided to fight back because I didn't do anything wrong, and I was just expressing what I was seeing. And I've treated now over 6,000 COVID patients. So I am an expert in that area, like you said, I was right. And now my goal is to get these COVID shots pulled off the market. And it's frustrating to me that, especially in Texas, we've eliminated mandates in Texas, but in my opinion, that's just not enough. These things are not safe. They should not be given to anybody, much less children. I mean, they're on the CDC vaccine schedule. So all children ages 6 months and older are expected to get these shots. It's hard to believe.
Wow. And and for a lot of parents then who go in and have their regular doctors say, here's the vaccine schedule for young children. I mean, is this something that is part of a package generally, or are parents actually informed that this is one of now the routine vaccines?
It's not combined in terms of, mixed with other substances. It's a separate shot. And but it's part of their 6 month wellness check, right? They're going to be offered this COVID shot. Now, I don't think the schools are requiring it, but still, if somebody's not educated and has full trust in their physician, they're going to get these shots, right? I think it's probably a minority, But my biggest thing is, okay, these people that we've elected to protect us, they're not getting these shots, and they're not giving them to their children, but why are they not speaking out about that? And, you know, if they're not safe enough for them, if they're not safe enough for their children, why are they safe enough for everybody else? And they're just too scared to speak up. It's still considered politically extreme to say that the COVID shot should be pulled off the market. It's very politically easy just to say, limit, you know, mandates. Well, we won't mandate it, allow people to choose. But this product is not safe. Any other product would have been pulled off the market a long time ago.
And I'm speaking with Dr. Mary Tally Bowden, who you can follow her on X at MD Breathe. So you have, as you said, treated now over 6,000 patients with COVID-19. So what were you seeing that led you to actually question this government narrative?
Well, so I started off doing testing, and you know, early on, you may remember, it was really hard to get a COVID test. And LabCorp was the first lab to have the test, and they got completely slammed. I was using this other test for patients with chronic sinusitis. I'm an ear, nose, and throat doctor, and it was a PCR test for bacteria and fungal infections. And they came out with a PCR saliva test for COVID. So it was great because the results came back very quickly. LabCorp was taking 2 weeks. These came back the next day, and it didn't require any kind of swab up the nose. So my little practice exploded because of that. And then I would tell people, well, go see your primary care doctor if they tested positive. And they'd come back to me and say, well, my primary care doctor won't see me. They just said, do nothing, you know, wait until you can't breathe. And that didn't sit well with me, so I started treating mm-hmm. patients. I tried hydroxychloroquine. Then, you know, Trump came out and said how great it was. We got shut down. So then I started doing breathing treatments. And then monoclonal antibodies came out. I started using those. But in the summer of 2021, and this was during the third wave of COVID, and this was 8 months after the shots came out, I started seeing all the breakthrough cases. And these patients, I started tracking it and who was vaccinated and who wasn't. And what I was finding is that I have seen just as many vaccinated. Actually, the vaccinated outnumbered the unvaccinated, and they were just as sick, if not sicker. And I actually went to Methodist Hospital, said, are you seeing what I'm seeing? And they gaslit me. And so that's when I started speaking out on social media and sending emails to my patients, and then they went after me.
Wow. And so what has what happened then after they went after you, and you know, did you continue to speak out? I mean, you actually sued the FDA for interfering with the doctor-patient relationship.
Right. I mean, I decided to fight back. I hired a lawyer. I held a press conference. I sued Methodist for defamation. And then I went after the FDA. We sued them over their misinformation about ivermectin. You may remember the famous horse tweet with the attractive healthcare woman nuzzling the horse. And you don't really need the caption, but it says, you're not a horse, you're not a cow. Seriously, y'all stop it. And that little innocuous-seeming tweet had dire consequences. It was it was swept up by the media. It went viral. It was used by pharmacists, by hospitals, even by courts, by judges, to deny patients the opportunity to take ivermectin. And, I mean, even to this day, I still have to jump through hoops to get my patients ivermectin. I cannot send a prescription to CVS or Walgreens and expect that they will fill it. I have to find an alternative source. We've got 3 years. We won the lawsuit in that the FDA was forced to remove that misinformation from their website and from social media. But we have three years of propaganda to reverse because it's still problematic in getting patients the medicine they need.
That, which in the United States, that just seems so contrary to everything that we expect from physicians. And patients trust doctors to not just go along with a preferred government narrative, but to actually treat them in the best way possible. And when something novel like the COVID-19 virus hits, then to have these other types of of ways and treatments that are and therapeutics and other things. And so, you know, right now we're seeing that for big pharma and for the for like, you know, Pfizer and some of these others that have created the vaccine, there is this liability shield from Congress. How damaging, in your opinion, is that to accountability and reversing all of the propaganda over the last 3 years?
It is crucial. It's the biggest legal hurdle we have. It's the PREP Act. And you know, everybody's celebrating the Ninth Circuit decision saying that the it's not a vaccine. But that actually still doesn't, the PREP Act still applies because it's not just vaccines. It's any kind of therapeutic, anything that was used towards COVID is legally protected. And it's just, but, you know, there's hope. Aaron Seary, he put out a tweet yesterday about this, and he's been at the forefront of the legal battle, saying that they're trying to challenge the PREP Act in court. There's also another case, Brooke Jackson, who's a Pfizer whistleblower. We're waiting on a decision for that. The DOJ is trying to get that dismissed. But that hopefully have an opinion on that soon. But that could take the House's cards down if they can prove the fraud in the trials. But yeah, the PREP Act is the biggest hurdle.
Wow, and I don't know if you listened to a lot of the testimony from Fauci in front of Congress, or just saw, you know, some of those clips and everything. But it seems like there was so much propaganda. There was so much that was genuinely evil, and the restrictions on doctors like yourself. And now, you know, we're seeing that he's just sort of flippantly saying, oh, yeah, I made up a lot of this stuff and a lot of this nonsense, like social distancing, masks for kids, all of these things. In your opinion, you know, when a doctor violates his oath that strongly and we see the devastating consequences, what does accountability really look like? I mean, what would you like to see changed?
Well, I remember when this started and people were throwing out Nuremberg, and I thought that was crazy, but now I don't. I think that, you know, we need full force accountability to the maximum extent so something like this never happens again. And yeah, I don't know what that looks like exactly. It's a little discouraging watching Fauci and all these other people in front of Congress because you feel like, well, they're talking, but there's no action. And you know, how are we? Where's the action? So I think we're all getting a little frustrated just watching them talk.
Yeah, and I'm speaking with Dr. Mary Talley Bowden, who you can follow on X at MD Breathe. And just in the last couple of minutes I have with you, and I so appreciate you being willing to stand up for the truth and, you know, against all of the nonsense and the propaganda and actually treat patients. But you mentioned that it's hard even today to fulfill certain prescriptions and therapeutics. What would you suggest broadly for, you know, for people who, if they're going to a doctor who doesn't want to treat them or who is, you know, kind of pushing the vaccine on them or whatever, what is the best practice in terms of still questioning all of this and not just yielding to still some of these things that are in place?
Well, if you have a doctor that's still pushing the vaccine, I would run. I mean, that's a red flag. I can forgive the people early on that, you know, maybe didn't know better, but you know, if they have a change of heart, have seen the light, that's okay. But if they are still pushing it, you need to find another doctor. FLCCC, Frontline Critical Care Doctors, has a list of like-minded physicians, American Frontline Doctors. So, yeah, there are options out there. I think I hear from more and more doctors all the time that are coming around, have seen the light, and are starting to become a little more proactive.
Yeah, and that's so important to be proactive and to always question things. And I have so much respect for you and other doctors who were willing to question that and just look and observe what was going on around you and say, well, maybe the propaganda is not true. And, you know, and there were so many questions, and I think it hit everybody so hard. Everybody was saying, you know, what's going on, and trying to make heads and tails of this. And we're seeing now, you know, 3 and 4 years later, some of the devastating consequences of people not questioning and just going along with the government narrative. So again, Dr. Mary Talbot Bowden, you can follow her at MD Breathe. And what a great testament to literally actually following the science instead of following the propaganda from the government. And she's absolutely right that this can never happen again in the United States. And I hope that it doesn't anywhere in the world. But we are already out of time this morning for Jenna Ellis in the Morning. You can always reach me and my team, Jenna, at AFR.net. Make it a great day. We'd like to thank our sponsors, including Preborn. Preborn has rescued over 200,000 babies from abortion, and every day their network clinics rescue 200 babies' lives. Will you join Preborn in loving and supporting young moms in crisis? Save a life today. Go to preborn.com.